Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Ryan Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good Monday morning, everyone. And we will begin the week with three great political analysts. We have Cokie Roberts, Jamelle Bouie, and Glenn Thrush all standing by together. And yes, we'll talk about the campaign news of the day. But I also want to try to get to another level to begin the week on the question of equivalency and false equivalency and how we talk about these things in the presidential campaign. Let me use yesterday's Meet the Press as an example. And this is not to single out Meet the Press or the host Chuck Todd, whose voice we'll hear. That's a serious-minded, earnest public affairs show. We could use many different examples. This is to raise a larger issue. But here it is. Here's Chuck Todd in the introduction to Meet the Press in what will sound like Clinton and Trump are about equal threats to America and to democracy as we know it. You'll hear the Meet the Press intro music underneath these first 22 seconds.
Finally, the toxic state of his campaign.
Through it all, he has continued pushing discredited conspiracy theories with racist undertones.
Hillary Clinton is a bigot who sees people of color only as votes.
And what voters think of it.
Sulfur, rotten eggs.
Dead fish.
Skunk.
Garbage.
So the Clinton and Trump accusations of bigotry against each other and voter reactions are presented as equal, tit for tat, Tweedledee and Tweedledum. A few seconds later, Chuck Todd goes on to frame the campaign week that was in a similar fashion.
But let's state the obvious on the campaign trail. It hasn't been a good week for either presidential candidate, frankly, or for the institution of American politics. A week that began with Donald Trump revamping his campaign leadership again, ended with him stating a new position on immigration. And then another, and then back again. The evolving do deport, don't deport statements confused the public and even left his own staff tongue-tied at times. At the same time, the FBI discovered some 15,000 new Clinton State Department emails, which will be released starting next month, guaranteeing that that issue will follow Hillary Clinton through the end of this campaign. And what's more, the Clinton Foundation faced pay-for-play charges and calls for the Clintons to distance themselves even further from the foundation if Hillary Clinton wins the presidency.
So that from yesterday set up to Meet the Press. And again, I'm not ripping Meet the Press or Chuck Todd, who are serious about what they do. I'm trying to raise a larger issue. Are there tough questions to ask about Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump equivalent to each other? And are they being presented to us as equivalent and maybe as falsely equivalent? With us now are Jamelle Bouie, chief political correspondent for Slate, Glenn Thrush, chief political correspondent for Politico and NPR and ABC News, political analyst and columnist, Cokie Roberts. Hi, Cokie. Hi, Jamelle. Hi, Glenn.
Hello, everybody.
So, hi. Glenn, to be very direct, I'm posing the possibility here that the questions about Trump are objectively about a unique set of threats to the nation, and the questions about Clinton are real to be sure, but they're just more ordinary about a mainstream politician. And then we hear them presented as kind of equivalent in those TV clips. Have you thought about this question, both the actual question of the potential risks and benefits of each candidate and the issue of how we talk about them in the media?
I've not only thought about it, I've had drinks and thought about it, Brian.
Deep. That's a profound way to start the morning.
Both alone and in groups. No, I think... Look, I think this is an extraordinarily important point here to make. Look, you know, Hillary Clinton has really, since the conventions, and really somewhat before the conventions, had a pretty gilded period of press coverage. And her polls have been consolidating. And Donald Trump had, you know, arguably, really, in that window around the convention, the worst month I've ever seen a presidential candidate have. I want to let you in, because I think you're somewhat acquainted with the logic of a newsroom. And that is, you cannot have one hand punching. I think there has been a feeling in my newsroom and in other newsrooms, and I think this is a reasonable journalistic impulse in terms of fairness and equal time, that so much negative coverage has been laid upon Donald Trump, the vast majority of it self-inflicted. You know, I should say the immigration flip-flop over the last week might arguably be the most significant policy development of his campaign ever. But even that was sort of washed away by other stuff. I think there is a feeling in newsrooms that Hillary has gotten a bit of a free ride over the last 6 weeks. He has gotten hit upon. And I think what we're seeing now is some compensatory coverage, particularly as you have, I think, a lot of criticism from Republicans about the media. And mind you, in the light of this incredibly divisive candidate who cannot unite his own party, remember, only about between 75 and 79% of Republicans are supporting Trump, a historically low number, the easiest target is the press. And I think people have been laying on us for hitting Trump, and Trump's been doing this relentlessly, too. So, you know, I think the Sunday shows are, they're kind of like McDonald's. They represent the entire spectrum of opinion in the country. And I think what you're going to see in those milieu, and I agree with you, Chuck Todd's great, but you're going to see, I think, a sense of trying to be equivalent. Whether or not it's false equivalence, I don't think you can judge by any given Sunday. I think you've got to look at the aggregate of the coverage.
Right. So before we bring in Jamel and Cokie, to follow up on something you said, is it the definition of a false equivalency that you make a decision in a newsroom to say, oh, we've been punching at this one too much, we're going to start punching at this one more so that we're punching equally? Maybe the stories, the realities, the truths just lead you to punch more at Trump.
Yeah, look, I think, again, it's the time, you know, David Plouffe, who I think is as canny an observer on the Democratic side of this as anybody, always talks about the long game. I think it is the long-term aggregate of coverage. Remember, the conversation we were having 4 months ago was that Donald Trump had gotten $2 billion in free media, right, and that it had catapulted him to the upper ranks of the Republican primary, and it had really fueled his rise. We're not so much talking about that now because it boomerangs. So I think in the fullness of time, we will see if this washes out. I mean, the one thing I will say about the Clinton Foundation and email scandals, I've tweeted this and I've written about it, I have yet to hear, apart from a process argument about violations, any demonstrable, on the foundation side, any demonstrable offshoot of pay-to-play, who actually enriched themselves, the Clintons enriched themselves. And on the email scandal, quote-unquote scandal, I have yet to hear anyone articulate for me how the national interest and national security has been placed at risk. And I think ultimately, Brian, that will be how both of those issues are judged.
Jamel, same question.
I'm pretty much with Glenn on this. It appears that there is an effort to sort of make up for the fact that Trump was the subject of a really terrible 6 weeks, 7 weeks, sort of a rolling terribleness when you begin to think about it longer term. And so the thinking is that, you know, the email story, the foundation story provide the basis for sort of more pointed coverage of Secretary Clinton. The problem, as far as I see it, is that the reason why there's been so much focus and negative focus is on Trump is because Trump has been an unusually negative force in the election, from his messages, which, you know, if you're feeling very charitable, you can call controversial. I think if you're being a bit more forthright, you would call on the border of playing the people's prejudices and people's bigotry, to his behavior as a candidate, which is sort of an extreme level of opacity, rather. So, right, he has not revealed his medical records. He refuses to reveal his tax returns. He is very opaque about his actual policy positions. He has essentially, hidden as much of his life as he can from view of the press. And so, to my mind, all of the negative criticism is completely deserved. And I don't, I myself do not think that there should be some obligation to then sort of, you know, we have to make up for this by doing more pointed criticism of Secretary Clinton, because I just don't see the same kind of problems coming from her camp. I do believe there ought to be examinations of the foundation and its conduct of her emails, but they're just simply not on the same level as what we're seeing from Donald Trump and his campaign. And so I don't know if that counts as false equivalence. I do think that reporters shouldn't feel bad that they find themselves going after Trump, because Trump has presented himself as a, you know, in a lot of ways, extremely troubling candidate for national office, and that and readers deserve, you know, a full examination of that.
Cokie, same question.
Well, I must say I'm having many, many thoughts go through my mind as I listen to these erudite folk. First of all, I think that often these are not conscious decisions. What Glenn was talking about of kind of a pulling back or trying to balance the scales is often somewhat unconscious, and it does sometimes come after a period of the media being criticized, and Trump has done a great deal of that again this weekend, just going full bore after the media, which plays very well in conservative political circles anyway. It's not such a great thing to do for the general electorate, but it, you know, it's not going to do him any harm. And look, I think that absent Donald Trump's missteps over the last few weeks, that we would have been paying a whole lot more attention to Hillary Clinton's problems. The truth is that the Comey statement, the director of the FBI, was mind-boggling. I was sitting there covering it live and thinking, dear Lord, where are we going with this? It was really somewhat shocking.
When he announced no indictment, but that she'd been extremely careless with classified material, that kind
exactly.
of thing.
Exactly. And so, you know, I think we would have been all over that story, and it would have been leading the news for days, except for that Trump kept putting his own, making it so that he was the lead of the news over and over and over again. And similarly, with this foundation story, the real problem with the Clinton Foundation, when you think about it, it's not that you can put a finger on one person or say this person got, you know, access that they wouldn't have had otherwise. People obviously would have access if they were the head of Brunei, or if they were someone who was Melinda Gates, would have access under any circumstances. The real problem is when you start thinking about unwinding the Clinton Foundation, and you say, okay, why don't they just do what Warren Buffett did, just give all of his money to Bill Gates? Well, you know, the truth is they wouldn't have the same kinds of contributions were it not the Clinton Foundation, and that in itself tells you what the problem is. There are people who are giving to that foundation because the name of it is Clinton, and they obviously expect something.
But then I'm thinking about how we have to ask tough questions about both candidates, but the questions that are supposed to make us ooh and ah are not qualitatively equal. Did Clinton grant some meetings as Secretary of State to people who donated to her family's charity? It, though we definitely should ask it and scrutinize it, is not the equivalent of why doesn't Trump know that Russia has already invaded Ukraine, or all his bigotry and authoritarian stuff and having almost no discernible policies on most major topics. Never mind the answers might not be equivalent. The questions about them are objectively unequivalent, but we often hear them presented in the same tone and language. Cokie, do you think about that?
For sure. And I do think that that there's always that problem. I mean, I remember years ago, Brian, writing a story about South African sanctions. And the vote in the House of Representatives was something like, 400 to 10. But giving, my 2 minutes of tape each in a 4-minute piece, giving 2 minutes to the pro side, 2 minutes to the anti side. And, is that fair? I mean, these questions of fairness absolutely do come up, and even when you think what you're doing is being fair. But I don't think that that Donald Trump has gotten anything like a free ride here. And the main thing to look at is the conservative columnist. I mean, look at David Brooks, George Will, Michael Gershon, Kathleen Parker, Charles Krauthammer. I mean, they are all over him. So I think that, you look at the editorial pages and op-ed pages of pretty much any publication, and there's not a lot of anything but shock and horror at Donald Trump going on.
Jamelle, you want to add anything to Cokie or go on a spur there?
I guess I would just say that I think the degree to which Clinton has not gotten scrutiny is occasionally overstated. So if you look at media coverage before this summer, and this is according to a Harvard study that came out, I think, in June, 83% of the coverage Clinton received prior to that was negative, often focused on stories like the emails. It's compared to 43% for Donald Trump. And Donald Trump's received almost an order of magnitude more coverage than Clinton did. And so I just don't see a media environment in which Clinton is not getting due scrutiny. And she may even be getting more scrutiny than your typical candidate, which I think would be appropriate given given sort of Clinton's place in American politics. What I still do find kind of wanting, and really the past 6 weeks is really the beginning of the kind of coverage I think we should be seeing of Trump, is placing Trump in his proper context, which is not as a typical major party nominee in any way whatsoever. And so I think the thing that troubles me as both someone who covers this election and who consumes an obscene amount of news about it is that I continuously see Trump sort of framed as typical in some way, shape, or form. And I just don't think that's true. I think that framing is inaccurate.
Typical? You think Trump is framed as typical?
I think he often is. I think he is, you know. So, for example, after he hired Stephen Bannon to be his campaign CEO, I saw plenty of this covered as just sort of, you know, controversial, operative Steve Bannon hired for the Trump campaign. You know, what impact will this have on his message and whatsoever. I think that the story there is not so much that, like, Bannon is controversial, but that in particular he has, like, concrete ties to white nationalists, and that, like, from sort of a 10,000-foot view here, the Trump campaign knowingly hiring someone with those kinds of ties is extremely troubling, and that's the story.
Yeah, and that raises different kinds of questions. And let me just invite listeners in as we talk to Jamel Bowie, who was just speaking, chief political correspondent for Slate, NPR's and ABC's political analyst and columnist Cokie Roberts, and Glenn Thrush, chief political correspondent for Politico, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And since you brought up Bannon, Let me play a clip. I thought on Fox News Sunday yesterday, Chris Wallace did a good job when he was interviewing the campaign manager for Trump, Kellyanne Conway, of bringing out some of the really, you know, like you were saying, Jamel, beyond controversial things that Bannon has written on Breitbart. Here's Chris Wallace.
Birth control makes women unattractive and crazy. And would you rather your child had feminism or cancer? And he has called, Breitbart has called, Bannon has called Breitbart the platform for the alt-right.
So, Cokie, were you trying to say something? And those headlines, unbelievable.
Yes, absolutely unbelievable. And Secretary Clinton repeated them in her speech last week in Reno, which I thought was actually a very forceful speech. I wouldn't be surprised if Steve Bannon is not with the campaign for a very long time. I think that'll be the next big story out of the Trump campaign. But yes, I mean, it is a shocking choice. That's the only word for it. And, you know, for those of us who had barely heard of the alt-right, all of a sudden, there it is, front and center, and he's the choice of him is something that you just scratch your head over when you see a candidate who's trying to attract more voters.
The alt-right, for people who find this a new term, kind of the white nationalist right, to be a little reductionist about it, but still. So, Glenn Thrush.
But I'd like to just say one other thing there, though, Brian. Jamel's point about not letting it become somewhat ordinary, a regular candidate. And I think that that's a very good point. It's one that the Washington Post editorial page has made over and over. Bob Garfield, our colleague on the media, has made, which is that, you know, we get into campaign coverage and it all becomes kind of the way we normally do things. And this is not normal. And it is important to keep pointing that out.
Glenn Thrush, can you explain what Trump is doing with a guy like Bannon at the same time as he hires the consultant Kellyanne Conway to try to professionalize his campaign?
You know, the hiring of Kellyanne Conway is the most significant and I think most healthy move that he's made in terms of getting his politics together. I mean, she really, she's a veteran pollster, and I think she has really righted the ship to the extent that it could best be righted. Look, in terms of the false equivalence thing, this is where I think it really is a huge problem. Donald Trump doesn't give a damn about policy. He doesn't have any intellectual curiosity, and he has no fixed views on anything, including immigration. This has been demonstrably proven. This is not a bias. This is this is what the texture of the campaign has been. Hillary Clinton tends to shift within a certain set of parameters on policy issues, and she is, I think, without question, apart from her husband, the most well-informed, studied presidential candidate on policy that we have ever had. Really, and you have to kind of go back to LBJ. So this is where I think we really dropped the ball. Policy is boring. I have written a ton of stories criticizing Hillary Clinton's laundry list approach to giving speeches, where she just goes up and down things. You know, parenthetically, on when she made her Roosevelt Island kickoff speech last year, I was with one of her senior aides, and Hillary was in the middle of making, I think she was maybe talking about mental health, which is a plan that she unrolled today. She was going bullet point by bullet point about what she would propose. This person, a senior Clinton person, grabs me by the arm and says, "Come on, I want to go get a Diet Coke." So you're dealing with to an extent the stultifying specificity with which she chooses to address the electorate and treating them like grown-ups works to her disadvantage. And I think that really is what we have got to emphasize. The debates will bring some of this out, but you're dealing with somebody who is at a differential calculus level on policy against a campaign which is very much learning its 1+1
yeah, but
equals
you know,
3.
But you know, Glenn, I mean, yes, we can point it out, but it's also true that in some ways we don't have to, because what happens with Trump, and he has said this himself, is that when he loves his rallies, and his rallies are everything to him. And when he starts talking policy, or he starts pivoting, as he puts it, the rallies get restless and bored. And that's when he says something that he shouldn't say. And that then becomes the dominant theme of the news cycle.
I think the fact that
he doesn't like dealing with policy is working against him, because it does make him do other things that he shouldn't be doing.
No, and I agree with you on that. The one thing I would add to that, Cokie, is it's not as if he would be talking about it if the crowds loved it. I mean, I did a podcast with Roger Stone, an on again, off again advisor, part of the menagerie, right? And Stone said to me.
Of Trump, yes.
Not Clinton, we should say, not Clinton. and Roger said, trying to brief this guy is really like trying to hurt a cat. I mean, he will not sit still for anything longer than a couple of sentences, and he doesn't read anything. To me, as somebody who has covered, and as you have as well, covered a real White House where every single day is about dealing with problems of great specificity, I think to me that is more than even his most outrageous statements, the most damning element of his candidacy, the fact that this guy doesn't do the homework. And the other thing about it that I want to point out is, even when he gets called on this, even on policy issues that he has been publicly exposed as not having any knowledge on, he doesn't go back and do his due diligence. I think that speaks, if we're talking about a presidential campaign as being a competition between two individuals, and we're trying to discern whether or not they can do the job, I cannot think of a set of actions or inactions by any candidate that would be more disqualifying than not studying the stuff you need to know to be president.
Glenn Thrush, chief political correspondent for Politico. Jamelle Bouie, chief political correspondent for Slate. NPR and ABC's political analyst and columnist Cokie Roberts all with us. And Lexi in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lexi.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me on the air. I'm a little nervous, but I'm thinking about an interview that you had with somebody maybe 2 weeks ago, and it was about Clinton Foundation emails, and the interview was like, well, what was actually in them? And I remember listening to the interview and thinking, I'm not hearing anything that seems so scandalous, like the people on your show have been talking about. It seems like this email thing, when the emails come out, it's like, oh, maybe like they did respond to this request, but we don't know if they met with them. They're not sure. It's like very, it seems almost benign compared to, obviously, comparing it to Donald Trump's fiascos. But so to me, it does seem like false equivalency. And to think that Hillary Clinton hasn't been scrutinized the way that Trump has is absurd, because she has been, like, for so long, for so many, many years. So I think it is fair to say that it's false equivalence. And if we're going to talk about something to make it more equal, why not scrutinize each candidate based on equivalence, like based on policy? Or why not look at Trump's emails? Or why not look at Trump's connections to foreign countries and in an equation with Hillary, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Anybody want
she
to
actually,
talk to
but us? She makes a very good point because of course we can't even really look closely at a lot of things Trump because he won't reveal his tax returns. So we don't know what kinds of mm-hmm. companies he's done business with and what kinds of whether he's paid any taxes, whether he's had foreign shelters, not to mention, you know, whether he's made any charitable contributions, all of those things. So it makes it very hard to do the kind of scrutiny that normally a presidential candidate would have. Now, we do point out over and over and over again that he hasn't released his tax returns, but that's not the same as actually looking at them.
All right. We have a couple of callers on the board. They're minority, but they're there, who want to say we've got the false equivalency backwards. It's really Trump who's being overly scrutinized compared to Clinton. And let's take John on Staten Island as an example of that. Hi, John. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I do think that you've got it a bit backwards here. And I think that it's probably a result of the kind of brain paralysis that comes when you look at things at a dichotomy. You know, the political spectrum goes beyond Trump and Clinton. And it just seems to me like the media are not only not looking at Clinton hard, but they're trying to let themselves off the hook by saying, gee, are we just sort of like, you know, look at what we're doing with Trump. We're not doing it with Clinton. So, well, come on. Look at Clinton. Look at what she's done.
Brian, can
okay, Glenn, go ahead. Talk to John.
So, John, the New York Times is allegedly the most liberal rag in the rag pile, right? And Trump has called it a failing institution that's actively on Hillary Clinton's payroll. The New York Times is the publication that broke the Hillary Clinton email story, took a lot of heat from the Clinton people on it, has pursued that story doggedly. The New York Times has also pursued, I think, a very aggressive set of stories on the Clinton Foundation. Most of the information that you are complaining about, that you are saying the media isn't covering, has in fact been uncovered by the mainstream, quote-unquote, liberal media. The right-wing media, you know, places like the Free Beacon and Breitbart and the Daily Caller have broken some stories in the campaign, but the vast majority of the negative stories broken about Hillary Clinton, the foundation, and et al., has been broken by the quote-unquote liberal mainstream media.
Well, I'm certainly not going to try to compare Breitbart with the Times. I mean,
I think the broader
everywhere are incredible.
Hang on. Let John finish his thought. John on Staten Island, go ahead.
Okay, you know, good journalists, God bless them, and Breitbart is certainly not the New York Times. But what I'm talking about is, like, you know, what's happening here on the talk show is like the casting of everything as Trump versus Hillary over and over and over and over again. When are you guys ever going to start looking at the policies from the other candidates? What about Stein? You know, I mean, she says that Clinton's dangerous because she's already done what Trump says he's going to do. Where's anything that resembles looking at that as if it were serious?
And
what
Clinton has done. By the way, we have we're trying to do Jill Stein and Gary Johnson and another third-party candidate back-to-back-to-back days next week. We'll see if that comes together. But we definitely have those invitations out for some prominent placements. But, John, yeah, you've mentioned a couple of times the things that Clinton has done that maybe we're not talking about enough. What things? John?
Look at her foreign policy situation. you know, the things that the Syria, the Libya, all that stuff, it just like it doesn't exist as an issue for the liberal press. They just gloss it over and they talk about comparisons with Trump's idiocy. I don't get it.
Cokie, what were you trying to say about that?
No, I was going to ask the same question of what were the things she's done.
Jamel?
I would just say two things. The first is that I think there's been a level of attention paid to Jill Stein and Gary Johnson commiserate with their odds of becoming president, right? So the Washington Post and the New York Times have run stories on both of their candidacies. I have read interviews with both candidates. I've watched town halls with both candidates. And they are not common, but they're there. And I think the extent to which they are not common, it's justified by the fact that neither Stein nor Johnson will be president come January 2017. And that the candidates that do stand a chance of being president, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, deserve the bulk of the media's attention. The idea that we would scrutinize and examine Jill Stein's proposals as if she stood a chance of becoming president, I frankly think is kind of absurd. There's a limited time and limited attention, and we ought to devote that time and attention to the candidates who will win come November.
I do wonder, though, what you each think about the threshold for third-party candidates getting into the debates. The current rules, I think, require 15% support in multiple national polls. Neither Johnson nor Stein has that. So neither of them probably will be in the televised debates when both major party candidates are very unpopular. And I wonder if each of you have been thinking about whether the standard for inclusion, to at least expose them to a wider audience, is what it should be. Glenn, do you have an opinion about this?
Well, do I have an opinion on this? I think the threshold, I mean, I'd personally be in favor of seeing the threshold drop to 10%. I think if you hit double digits, that's probably a good indication. But I also think airtime should be allocated based on that as well, that if someone is only polling at 10%, they should have less of a capacity to interact. But listen, Brian, you know, the caller hits at a really fundamental issue here. You know, Hillary Clinton is "quote unquote" dominating in the national polls, with numbers nationally and in some states that are 43-45%. Simply for that reason, you have a 15-20%, really around 17 now, percentage of the electorate that doesn't like either one of these candidates. There's never been an election in the recent past, with the exception of 1992, when you had so many people who were hankering for a third-party alternative. Now, I have spent some time interviewing Gary Johnson. I'm trying to get Jill Stein on my podcast. But, Johnson, the problem with Johnson is he's a tweener. He appeals on social issues to progressive Democrats. You know, he ran a cannabis company, and he's a libertarian on economic issues, so he loses a lot of those people on that as well. And he's also sort of as a messenger. He's entrepreneurial, he's amusing, but he doesn't project the gravitas, the presidential gravitas that he would need to do to kind of get onto the larger stage. So I think part of the issue here is not just media attention, but it's the quality of the individual candidates. I think if Gary Johnson were really blowing people away, he would be doing much, much better.
It could be.
Well,
that
the problem is, you know, but I can sing this one round or flat.
Go ahead.
The truth is that you can make a case that they can't get to 15% in the polls without having the kind of exposure that a national debate will give them. And, you know, Ross Perot, when you talk about 1992, and of course Bill Clinton won that election with 43% of the vote.
Right.
So Ross Perot did hit the threshold and by pretty much every account won the first debate. And as you recall, he was doing very, very well. But the big difference here is that Ross Perot was able to get on 50 state ballots. There is no way on earth that these candidates can get on 50 state ballots. And so then to take up precious debate time when you really are paying attention, many, many voters really for the first time, to take up that time with a candidate who cannot possibly get to the finish line, I think does not make a lot of sense.
I'll just add before we go on to another caller that maybe there's something to be learned at the federal level from what they do here in New York City, where the official debates run by the Campaign Finance Board, which I've had the privilege of moderating some of, have both by design and by requirement some all-inclusive debates where all the mayoral candidates on the ballot are on the same stage, and some that are called leading candidate debates, which are usually just the Democrat and the Republican, because there is a, you know, a polling qualification to get in.
You'd never get them to agree to it, Brian.
Really?
They wouldn't agree to
even one.
It's hard enough to get them to agree to what they've agreed to.
By the way, it should be noted, Trump has not officially agreed to participate in all three debates yet.
Yes.
Is there any
true.
Question about that? I mean,
sure.
I know the first
sure
one, just
is.
To remind listeners of the issue, the first one is coming up at Hofstra on Long Island on September 26th. But, yes, Trump has complained about it being opposite Monday Night Football and wanting a different night of the week. So it's not a foregone conclusion that he'll participate in that?
No, nothing's a foregone conclusion.
Exactly.
Or resolved, I should say. Yes, nothing's resolved. Is that where we're going to leave that?
I think, by the way, Nothing is Resolved is a great title for a campaign book here.
Stephen River.
Or as Kellyanne put it, to be determined.
Right.
Stephen Riverdale, you're on WNYC, or Nothing is Illuminated, if you want to.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. And my question was about the debates in terms of what impact do you think they will have on the race? Will they stimulate a high turnout? And if so, could there be a flipping over both the Senate and the House into the Democratic side?
Jamel, what is at stake, in your opinion? Assuming the debates go off as scheduled, what could change? I do hear the analysts on the cable channel saying, oh, well, the next big opportunity, maybe the last best opportunity for Trump is the debates.
So typically, debates don't have as big of an impact as I think people imagine they do. Typically, debates, what they do is they activate partisans on both sides. But, you know, you look at where polls are, aggregate polls are on the eve of debates and then after them, and they usually begin and end in the same place. There's no meaningful effect. So in 2012, you know, Obama had a small lead over Romney going into the debates. There was lots of volatility during the month of the debates because of the varying performance. And then once they were over, things were basically where they were when they began. I think this year might be different because the presence, you know, I don't see these third-party votes as necessarily being hardened votes. If you look at surveys of people who are, say they vote, will vote third-party, many of them are uncertain about their vote in a way that isn't true of either Trump or Clinton supporters. I think the third-party vote at this stage still represents basically I don't know or I am uncertain. And so I think because we have this unusually large number of uncertain voters, I think the debates may end up having a substantial effect on the race going forward. And so let's say Trump does not participate at all, that would have a major effect. Let's say he does and loses quite badly, that would have a major effect in Clinton's favor. And I think likewise, if Clinton participates and does very badly, that could really benefit Trump. But either way, I do think that will come out of this debate season with some sort of meaningful change in the numbers, which is a little unusual.
Before you,
you know,
all go,
1980 was the debate that really did make a huge difference. The only debate between Reagan and Carter, and one of the reasons that it did make such a difference is people were looking at it who kind of wanted to like Ronald Reagan, but were nervous about him. But after an hour and a half on the stage with the President of the United States, they were no longer nervous about him. Now that's it's possible that Trump could pull off something like that. We'll see.
Well, I guess that's where we're going to leave it for today. What a great conversation. I want to thank everybody for engaging. Jamel Bowie, Chief Political Correspondent for Slate, Glenn Thrush, Chief Political Correspondent for Politico, and NPR's own and ABC's two political analyst and columnist, Cokie Roberts. Thank you all very much.
Good to be with you guys.
Thank you.